you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us today. Coming up later this hour, the terrific singer and songwriter Jose James will be with us in studio. He'll be performing a bit for us, talking about his new album named for the year of his birth, 1978, and some of the great American musical influences of that very same year. I also want to mention that we have a brand new Air Talk weekly newsletter that's going out to Air Talk listeners. All you have to do is subscribe. Of course, it's free, and it gives me an opportunity to off-air have some communication with you, to pick out some of my favorite segments, talk about some of the things going on behind the scenes with Air Talk that you might find interesting. So please sign up for Air Talk weekly, which debuts next week. Every week, it'll be right there in your email inbox. You can sign up by going to our AirTalk page at laist.com/airtalk. That's laist.com/airtalk. Every week gives me a chance to write to you and other AirTalk listeners about what's going on with the program. Make sure that you're an original subscriber by signing up this week for the launch of it next week. We begin with the stubbornly high gas prices here in California. We're, of course, used to having the most expensive or nearly the most expensive gasoline in the United States. That continues as we're getting set for the introduction of the summer fuel blend, which also causes prices to go up. But this raises the ongoing question of why do we pay so much more for gasoline when we have so many people who are highly dependent on having to drive to and from work? With housing prices so high here, it means that we have many longer distance commuters because they can't afford to live close to where they work. So these higher gas prices hit them particularly hard. With us from Gas Buddy, the head of petroleum analysis, Patrick DeHaan. Patrick, thank you for joining us this morning. First of all, where do we stand on the average price of gasoline in California now?
Well, the average price has jumped up another 21 cents a gallon in the last week alone. That compares to the national average, by the way, which is up just 7 cents. The statewide average in California now at $5.34 a gallon. One has to go back to last fall to find a higher price.
What seem to be the factors at play here?
Well, many of the factors that bog down California's refinery supply chain and certainly causes prices to go up, an extensive amount of refinery maintenance, which is somewhat normal this time of year. Now, in the backdrop, this hasn't been an issue, within the last 10 years or so. Prior to that, there was more refining capacity and more refineries. But as California has seen conversions of refineries to producing more things like biodiesel and renewable products, that's unfortunately had a negative impact on overall capacity. And California now, with its big demand for gasoline, one of the top gasoline-consuming states in the nation, the lack of refining capacity as other refineries are undergoing maintenance is problematic. Not only that, but California also having a patchwork of regulation. It's the only state in the nation that has a type of gasoline mandated not by the EPA, but by the Air Resources Board. And different dates for these blends, depending on where you are in the state, add to the complexity and logistical challenge of making that changeover, which unfortunately has a negative consequence of boosting prices.
We're talking with Patrick DeHaan, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. Also with us, Milken Institute chief economist William Lee. The Milken Institute is an independent think tank based in Santa Monica. Bill, good to have you with us again. Anything to add in terms of the reasons behind these prices and our increase being so much higher than what's happening in other states?
I absolutely support what Patrick just said. The environmental regulations in California and the logistical challenges posed by the very many different blends here are really the heart of the matter. But I think one other factor is that the war in the Middle East with Hamas has really pushed up crude oil prices tremendously. back even as late as January, February, oil prices were well below $75 a barrel. Now they're $85 a barrel. And that pushes up costs for all refiners. But here in California, and especially in the L.A. area, because of the kind of blending that's used here, very few refineries are able to produce that blend that's needed because of the environmental regulations here. So the price of being on the bleeding edge of green technology and green transition is the price that the consumers here in L.A. have to pay. So in some ways, L.A. consumers are financing the green revolution more so than anywhere else in the United States.
Bill, about a year ago, there was legislation passed, and I know it was watered down, but this was Governor Newsom's way of trying to respond to the higher gas prices and all the complaints that state legislators and the governor was getting about those prices. So they were asking the State Energy Commission to, you know, look at what was behind the prices and what was a fair return for oil companies to and refiners to be able to get for gasoline. I haven't heard anything come of that. Have you?
No, I haven't. In fact, I think that kind of initiative generally gets stalled with studies that last many, many years. And one of the problems is that when you try to talk about equity, is it fair for Los Angelians and Californians in general to be financing the green transition? People ask the question, well, if we don't do it here in California, where the environmental regulations are the tightest, who does pay for this? And the federal government says, well, we are putting most of the bill because of the added infrastructure we're putting in place and so on. But the kind of infrastructure that's being put in place assumes that you already have an electric vehicle. Most of us can't afford one. When the price of electric vehicles and Teslas are $50,000 to $100,000, that's way beyond the reach of people. So the legislatures really haven't decided on how to manage the transition well. They want to get to a certain goal. They want to incentivize that new goal, but they're not putting the money forward to get us from here to there, especially for those who are, most of us who are living hand to mouth. The average household is really not having very much success in keeping up with inflation.
And Bill, let's talk about that a little bit because, we have very competing narratives about what's happening with inflation. I hear many economists say, really things have settled down substantially and the economy is overall doing well. I hear from others that, for working class Americans, middle class Americans, that because of the dramatic increase in gasoline prices and in food prices that we've seen in the most recent years, that in terms of percentage of what eats household income has hit that sector particularly hard and that they really have not done as well. So what's your sort of macro assessment of that?
I think the number that everyone should keep in mind is that when you look back over the last 4 years, inflation has risen faster than the average family income, or actually the median family, that's the guy in the middle of the income distribution. It's dropped by about 5% in inflation-adjusted terms. If you go back 8 years between the beginning, 16 to 19, you find that the same median family income number rose by almost 13%. So people were saying, I was doing really well before the last 5 years, and over the last 5 years, I seem to be losing ground. Well, that's a very real number because inflation really has shot up much more than the median family income.
We're talking with William Lee, chief economist at Santa Monica-based Milken Institute, Patrick Daw, head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy. So, Patrick, as you look at the summer when demand for gasoline goes up as more people drive, and you look at the summer blend and the effect of that, you were mentioning earlier that fewer refineries are able to make the sophisticated blends that we do here in California. What is this going to mean for summer driving?
Well, it's going to mean probably more pain than what we've seen in the winter months. Now, the good news for most motorists is that traditionally, if everything goes well, refinery maintenance will be wrapping up here over the next 4 to 8 weeks. That could mean more pain before any sort of improvement. But typically, gas prices peak early on in the summer. Shortly after this transition is made, refineries tend to finish maintenance and then they're able to boost production of this summer blend of gasoline. And so we may be seeing some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of prices may peak in the next 4 to 8 weeks. Now, last year, the peak actually occurred in fall because refineries entered maintenance a little early. Some of that was unexpected. When you have refineries that on average are 70 to 80 years old, problems can arise. But traditionally, prices should be peaking in the next 4 to 8 weeks. And unfortunately, there may be more increases. But I think once things settle down, if they do settle down, we could see prices starting to decline in June and towards July. And that's because that blend of summer gasoline tends to build up once refiners are done doing maintenance. And really through the summer, the biggest question is, as the price of oil has gone up, will that continue over the duration of the summer, offsetting some of what we see in a projected decline with prices? It's going to be another painful summer, no doubt about it. And adding into that, refinery issues have been more frequent as of late. Part of that is because the state simply doesn't have as many refineries around anymore. And part of that is certainly regulatory, in that it's been a very tough environment in California to produce gasoline.
And yet, aren't oil companies making substantial profits out of California?
Well, they are. In part, this has been a setup that has been born out of political agendas. That is, the state has frowned upon refining activity, which has benefited the refineries that are doing business in California significantly. And I think to your earlier question, why haven't we heard anything about the California Energy Commission? What have they found out? Well, as Governor Newsom himself last fall initiated a waiver of California standards, the price of gasoline plummeted from $6.06 a gallon to $4.58 a gallon after that waiver was issued. What we find out often, and politicians as well, is find that this is very political, that regulatory burdens on the sector have created this mess. And oftentimes, that's why we don't hear from the government itself on what has alleviated the problems, is it's oftentimes regulation.
Of course, we're trying to transition out of a fossil fuel economy to one that is cleaner and that doesn't produce the same CO2 emissions as we currently do in California. And Bill, let's talk a bit about that transition, because we've seen it, of course, with electricity production and more renewables coming on, concerns about whether there were going to be shortages, but battery technology has improved there. We have seen technology when it comes to electricity lead to significant improvements with CO2 emissions and with greater reliability in the past couple of years. Is there any way forward with that sort of transition away from a gasoline-based transportation economy to see technology fill this gap?
We actually can make that transition. In fact, you actually see it in China. The subsidies they've given electric vehicle manufacturers has flooded China and now threatening to flood the rest of the world with very cheap, affordable electric vehicles. The problem is the kind of difficulties of allowing competition to take place here is still holding things back. But the key thing that's holding things back is that transition infrastructure. We just don't have the capacity to service all these electric vehicles that we want to have on. And also, most of us can't afford it. As I keep saying, it's great to finance this transition. And a lot of the people who are driving their Teslas right now have made that transition, and they are there. But unfortunately, the bulk of the population in Los Angeles and California just can't afford electric vehicles the way they're produced now. And if we want to make them affordable, we can let in a flood of Chinese electric vehicles coming here. BYD offers a lot of affordable electric vehicles, but that's not politically a reliable way of doing things. And that's certainly not good for U.S. Economic security and other issues.
Janet in Culver City emailed, adjusted for inflation, gas prices are lower than they were in 1978. If gas prices in the U.S. reflected the cost of the environment, health, and help pay for mass transit infrastructure, prices would be a lot higher. I think there's no question about that. So true. I think, you know, the difference is we have so many people, even post-COVID, or post-pandemic, I should say, who commute very long distances, probably much more than we saw 40 or so years ago. And for those people particularly, for people who live comparatively close to work or aren't going into the office on a regular basis, have curbed the miles driven, it's not hitting their households as high. But for that sector of the population, much of the working class, much of the middle class who are driving longer distances in California because they're living farther from their jobs, that is, for them, of course, something we hear about a lot. I want to thank our guest, William Lee, who's chief economist at the Milken Institute and the head of petroleum analysis at Gas Buddy, Patrick DeHaan, for joining us. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about the IRS's direct file, one of its pilot states in which it's testing this tax preparation service run by the IRS, is here in California. We'll find out from The Hill economics reporter Tobias Burns how direct file, as it's called, is working. We'll be back in just 1 minute.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in a few minutes, Jose James, terrific singer, composer, has a brand new album out, 1978. Minneapolis born and now lives here in Southern California. We'll talk with him about some of his greatest musical influences, including Marvin Gaye, whole album that he did, terrific album dedicated to Bill Withers, and we'll hear him perform in studio. That's Jose James coming up in just minutes right here on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. But right now we turn our attention to Direct File, which is a pilot program being tried out in a number of states, 12 of them total, including California. But a lot of people haven't even heard of this pilot program, which is essentially a tax preparation for people to file their returns online. With us from the publication The Hill, economics reporter Tobias Burns. Tobias, good to have you with us today.
Hi, thanks very much for having me. Good to be here.
So, Americans have been able to do their own taxes and to file them themselves. What is it that Direct File offers that's new in the 12 states that offer this for a select group of filers?
Well, this is really about functionality, right? There have been private sector options that offer much the same kind of product for many years, and this is really the first time that the IRS itself is coming out with an ostensibly pretty high functioning piece of software that many people now who've been familiar with digitally filing and e-filing their tax returns that they can now use directly on the IRS website themselves. So this is many critics have said this is should be something that should have been offered a long time ago, but this is really the first time that we're seeing the IRS provide its own interface that can act as a competition, basically, to many private sector options.
Sounds like people who have money that they receive for contracting, who are paid that way, who file 990, they're not able to be included in this. So what's the criteria for those that are using this service this year?
Right. So this is a sort of a beta. If we were in the private sector here, we would refer to this as kind of a beta program. The IRS calls it a pilot program, but it's this is really for wage income for 1040 and W-2 filers who are filing their tax returns as people who make wages, and that excludes a lot of different kinds of income. Right. You can't have rent income. You can't have investment income on this. This is really the core way that people make money here is the only kind of income that this current version of the system can handle. That said, this is the first year it's coming out. There have been other government software programs in the past that have With their rollouts have not been as smooth as this one. This one has not had any technical issues. It is modest in its scope and ambition, but it certainly can be scaled up from here. You're right in pointing out that the 1099-K form, which is used by a lot of independent contractors, so-called gig workers, Uber and Lyft drivers, people with their own businesses, they won't be able to do it this year. But the IRS says, you know, this could certainly be possible in the future, and it's a good place to start.
So for people that are using it now, it sounds like they have pretty simple tax returns anyway. So what's the advantage of using direct file if it's people earning wages, you know, people who are taking deductions can't use it, people who are independent contractors can't use it? What's the benefit?
Well, the benefit is that it's free. That's the big one. And there's been a lot of controversy with the private sector, with the tax preparation industry over the past couple of years. We've even seen there's a precursor program to this known as Free File, which was a public-private partnership between a consortium of tax preparers and the IRS that sort of, you know, kind of laid the groundwork for this in ways. But that was really controversial. And there was some amazing reporting by ProPublica that really showed how that ostensibly free offering as a product of this partnership was actually used to just, you know, advance commercial interests there, which I suppose is not that surprising. But it, on the other hand, that's exactly what it was designed not to do. It was supposed to be a free option. It ended up not being a free option, and that's not how it's supposed to work. So the real advantage of this, and I think there is kind of a philosophical dimension to this too, in a way, is that, you know, this is a free offering, and paying taxes is a civic duty. And many critics have said, you know, this needs to be kind of the default way we think about things in terms of filing taxes, as opposed to, you know, having to pay for them itself. And I should just offer one brief correction to you there. This can handle some of the biggest and most important deductions that there are, the credits. It doesn't handle itemized deductions. If you have very specific business expenses that you need to account for, but it can handle the child tax credit. It can handle the credit for other dependents, some very important things for middle income and lower income filers that are built into this system.
What about tax deductible contributions to nonprofits? Is it able to handle that?
I don't believe so. No, I think it's just the kind of a standard set of core deductions, three or four there, and comparable tax credits as well.
I asked this, someone who works for a nonprofit that receives tax deductible contribution. We're talking with Tobias Burns, economics reporter for The Hill, who's talking about Direct File, which is a new service by the IRS. The latest I saw is only about 50,000 people in the 12 states have used it so far. And Tobias, how much of that do they think is the fact that people don't even know it's available?
Yeah. This is an issue here. I mean, with the tax prep industry, they spend orders of magnitude more money in advertising their products. They have very sophisticated advertising companies and public relations firm that know exactly how to reach their target demographic. These are very well established industries and practices there. And this is the IRS, and it's government. It's kind of more straightforward, a little bit less dynamic, I suppose. But, you know, they've certainly been, the IRS has certainly been making an outreach, at least to reporters. You know, I've been on many calls this tax season and before, listening to the design of this system. There have been nonprofit consultants and university consultants who've worked on this, who really, you know, made studies about this. So the outreach is an important component of this as well. Yeah, 50,000, I think it's, the last number I saw was 50,000 earlier in this tax season. They said that they were trying to hit around, you know, in the several hundred thousands. That's what they were anticipating. So, you know, it's a bit on the low side so far, but it's within the realm of I think their aspirations, and they're hoping to get more people signed on as they go.
Tobias, at this point, what percentage of Americans use professional tax preparers versus filing their own returns?
Well, that number has actually been going down in as we've seen more people actually file their taxes online. So The Hill recently did a bit of an analysis of past tax returns, where we looked About a decade ago, it was in the low 80s, about 80% of people were filing their tax returns online in some way. And now it's in the mid 90s, it's over the past, 1% a year, ticking up with more and more online digital participation in filing their taxes. And as we've seen that trend continue, we've seen actually the number of tax preparers, professionally prepared tax returns, diminish. And that's interesting because it suggests that as people are going online, there's more autonomy, there's more knowledge about how this stuff actually works, and that could be construed as a positive trend. At the same time, there is really a fierce battle raging here. There's been a huge amount of lobbying with some of the biggest tax preparers like Intuit, which makes TurboTax. They hit a record last year for lobbying to make sure to make sure that their products are still available to people. So there's a big battle happening behind the scenes here about just what these programs can do and what they're designed to do.
And for that percentage of people that don't use professional tax preparers, is it thought that the majority of those people use software like TurboTax, or do we know?
Well, there are the tax prep industry, yeah, there are many products out there by various companies, but there's also direct e-filing, which is sort of a precursor program with the IRS that's been available for a long time. There are all kinds of different ways that you can file your taxes with the IRS, but this there's really a lot of aspiration within the agency right now to make this one of the big new methods that they're hoping to see gains popularity. I mean, this was mandated, this pilot program, by the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, where they wanted to sort of study the level of interest among people, and they got sort of resounding confirmation from this, at least according to their own studies. So we'll see what the future holds for this program.
We're talking with Tobias Burns, economics reporter for The Hill, the publication. He focuses on U.S. tax policy. Tobias, I know Republicans have been critical of direct file. What do we know about its potential future, given the composition of Congress? Is this something that may run into strong political headwinds, even though the funding has been made for the pilot program?
Yeah, so this is a massive point of contention right now. We have a divided Congress, of course. We've got Republicans in control of the lower chamber, and the Senate is still controlled by Democrats. So, as soon as Republicans retook the House following the 2022 midterms, the first bill that they passed was a rescission of the IRS funding. And just as a bit of background, IRS in the Inflation Reduction Act, which was kind of the big seminal piece of legislation, passed when Democrats controlled both the White House and both chambers of the legislature. That funding was immediately taken away, that $80 billion, and it really is still a negotiating point. During two of the budget negotiations over the course of last year, that funding, that initial $80 billion funding boost, was walked back two times. In the first iteration, they took back $10 billion for calendar year 2024, and then $10 billion for 2025. And then in the second iteration, they actually packed those together, meaning that they would slash that funding boost for the IRS by about a quarter in just the first year. So that's a pretty rapid rate of rescission for this this major refurbishment that is going into the IRS. So it's touchy. It really is, especially when you have these large scale ambitions from one of the most important government agencies there is. And they're changing their operational structure. They're using more analytics, AI. They're centralizing a lot of their protocols. And when the money has been tanking away under those ambitious plans, it's a bit precarious. So yeah, the Republicans do not want to see this move forward. Democrats do, obviously, and it's an ongoing fight for sure.
Tobias, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate you giving us the very latest on Direct File, the pilot program from the IRS. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Thank you. Economics reporter for The Hill, Tobias Burns. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll be talking with singer, composer, guitarist Jose James, who's produced a number of outstanding albums. He's performed on major stages around the world, lives in Southern California, and he's with us in studio. He's going to perform a bit, talk about his new album, 1978, and about the musical influences that have led to his highly diverse musical productions. We'll talk with Jose James when we come back in just 90 seconds.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Listening to Planet Nine from the new album 1978, the year of his birth, in fact. Jose James joining us, born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, now lives in Southern California, but he's traveled the world performing in some of the largest musical venues. And his sound is highly eclectic. If, like me, you listen to his albums when they come out, you know how eclectic. The influences are jazz, rhythm and blues, hip-hop, a wide range of music, and also political concerns that come to the fore in his music. We're so glad to have him with us in studio. Jose James, great to have you with us.
Amazing to be here. This is awesome.
Thanks so much. You said it's like the fastest sound check you ever
got.
Yeah,
the fastest, the best sound check I've ever done.
If only they could do that at these other
venues. It's all downhill from here.
That's right. So, first of all, let's talk about the new album, 1978. Your musical influences from the 70s, I know, are a lot. Anyone's listened to Bill Withers' tribute album you did and so many others. What is about that music from, you know, around the time when you were born that so connects with you?
It's so human to me, you know, like regardless of the genre, if I'm listening to Billy Joel or Roberta Flack or, you know, Al Green, it just feels like I'm in the room with them. They're telling me stories, you know, and there's something, such a warm sound to the 70s. And it's funky, you know, it's really funky. I love it, you know, and I'm a huge fan of James Taylor and all these incredible singer-songwriters who were creating great work in that time. And of course, Stevie.
Yeah, you know. Of course. I know that for you, as for so many of us, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On is just, it's a singular album.
And as
a musician who recognizes, even beyond, I mean, all of us know the message of it. We know how addictive the music is. But from a musician's perspective, why is that album so important?
That's a great question. You know, well, he made that album in 10 days, which is like legend for all of us artists. You know, I think he was the first one to take R&B and kind of to another level, make a suite out of it, and pull in not only like the incredible musicians, but the songwriters, the arrangers, and to present something so cohesive. It's thematic. It's a novel. It's classic. You know, it's political. It's social. It's spiritual. It's religious. It's interesting. It's challenging. You know, and to me, it's the high bar of R&B.
Yeah, beautiful and moving and urgent all at the same time. When you were talking about doing the album in 10 days, just reminded me, and I'm sure you know the story about him creating the track in his home studio for the national anthem at the NBA All-Star game. Yeah. And he's running in the car to get there and gets there late, but just in time to perform that epic national anthem, Marvin Gaye. So many incredible stories to tell. In 1978, just share with us about the influences that you're bringing to this new album.
Well, I was lucky enough to see the Bad Tour of Michael Jackson in 1988, and that changed my life. You know, I grew up listening to Off the Wall. That was like my favorite album. Prince, of course, I'm from Minneapolis, so Purple Rain was huge, you know, and seeing him around town and you know, somebody who looked like me on the national and international stage was huge, you know. But just artists like, you know, the Bee Gees, ABBA, like, all of that is just so fun to me. And I feel like, you know, in jazz can be very serious, you know, and I think it's kind of like nice to do some fun stuff. Of course, I did a Bill Withers tribute. So singing Lovely Day for 2 or 3 years kind of changed my aspect. I was like, this is really fun, you know?
Well, and you know, when you signed to Blue Note, Don, was, you know, you had a lot of freedom, even though it's a jazz label. You know, you were seemingly really encouraged to do your thing as well. And, you know, this is what jazz needs, of course, to move it forward. A variety of different musical influences. You said it can be very serious, but it needs, like all music needs, to be influenced by what's happening now.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, Robert Glasper did a great job with that. Don Was is such a legend. Shout out to Don. He really, I don't know if he 100% agreed with all my choices, but he supported all of them. And I think that's, you know, very rare in this business. So, yeah, big love to him.
So speaking of what's going on now in the world, let's listen. We just cued this a bit ahead to get to your vocal. But this is 38th in Chicago, off the new album 1978, references the intersection in Minneapolis where George Floyd was murdered May 2020. So here, Jose, you've got this Brazilian sound, it seems to me, and these very vivid, powerful lyrics. And speak to the art of creating this song.
Well, the first song I wrote actually in L.A. 5 years ago for the album was for Trayvon. And it's the same chords that goes into 38th Chicago. So it's kind of like a sweet, like Marvin style. And yeah, you know, my dad is Panamanian. I think that Latin, Afro-Cuban Latin rhythm is all in me. You know, Pedrito Martinez is the percussionist on there. He's from Cuba. And the thing about this song, and you mentioned what's going on, it's like, I feel like a lot of Black protest is about keeping it dancing, keeping it in your body while you're thinking about and feeling these things, because it's a lot to process. I was in Minneapolis just a couple of days ago at 38th in Chicago. I went and paid, you know, respects to George. And it's heavy. It's heavy stuff. So I feel like if you're moving your body, you know, and kind of having at least a good feeling about it, you can process a lot of the grief and the emotion.
Well, this Stevie Wonder's Living for the City. It's Marvin Gaye. So many of the artists who Edwin Starr's War. I mean, these are songs that are get your body moving at the same time. The message is quite stark and powerful.
That's right. And Bob Marley and the Wailers, you know, masterfully did that. Kaya came out in 1978, too, so that was the world's introduction to reggae. So for me, it's all tied in. You know, it's all important. And the 70s, they were about parties, but they were also about protest and politics.
We're talking with Jose James, singer, songwriter, guitarist, and he brought his guitar into studio and Air Talk. And I understand you're going to play Place of Worship. Is that right?
Yeah, I think Place of Worship feels like the appropriate thing to do. Shout out to Xenia Franca on that. Mm-hmm. say, I hear the river call my name. Some days I want to fly away, but I fall on my knees and praise. Lord, raise me up and show the way, and bring me to a higher place. I'm trying, God, sometimes I fail. The devil out here giving chase. Your vision is my saving grace. Wanting to fly away. Why did you say goodbye to me? I crossed the sand, across the sea. I left my heart, you took my name. Yeah, my brother, don't cry for me. Lost in the dark, but now I see. And tell my sister I am free. See you again when next we meet. We thank you. Bless you, we bring you back to the one, we uplift you, we praise you, we return you back to the one.
Jose James, Place of Worship, performing live on Air Talk in Studio A at LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation with Jose, and let's go to the break. Let's listen to For Trayvon. 1978, Jose James' new album.
Free from all below, I see your face so clear before me. Yesterday I saw your face. It was my own brother's son.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
Father, we. Up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts my eyes. And something without warning, love, bears heavy on my mind. Then I look at you, and the world's all right with me. Just one look at you. I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
Classic Bill Withers song is interpreted by Jose James, his 2018 album Lean On Me, a tribute to Withers. I had the pleasure of being in the Hollywood Bowl audience when he brought that recording live to the stage. I think Withers was not at that point in health that he could attend that evening. I think his daughter was in the audiences, as I recall. But was there communication between the two of you as you were making this album, Jose James?
There was. I was honored to meet him through Don. Don introduced us. We had dinner together in here in L.A. And, man, he was so funny. He was such a funny guy. He could have been a stand-up comedian.
Like, really?
Easily. Easily.
He had a great backstory, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't a professional musician. It was one of those guys who had, I can't remember if he worked in a warehouse. He had some other job, and then he ended up being
Boeing.
a huge recording artist.
I know. You know, and it's a crazy success story, only in America kind of situation. And I was so nervous because it's Bill Withers, you know, and I'm thinking, man, I don't want to mess this up. I don't want to miss any of his favorite songs as a songwriter. And I was kind of pestering him, like, can he look at the songs? And I emailed him after, and he said, "Yeah, I wrote all those. They're all
he wasn't picky.
Yeah, they're all fine. They're all good." Yeah. But he really gave me permission as a songwriter to interpret them freely, which was, I mean, an honor doesn't even begin to describe it.
I only saw him in performance once. I think it was at the Greek Theater, as I recall. He was funny. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about how old he was, but at that point, he wasn't really all that. He was maybe 50 or something. He's talking then like he was an old man. It was pretty funny.
That's funny.
Still with a great voice and a great performer. Jose, let's talk about, again, back to 1978, because it's not, you know, some of your albums have been very jazz-oriented, others have been other influences. Where do you see jazz going? You mentioned Robert Glasper. There's mm-hmm. so many interesting artists, Thundercat, people that are moving the music, Esperanza Spalding, into whole new areas. Where do you see the art form going?
That's a great question. I mean, I see it going in the two directions. It seems to always go, which is backwards and forwards, you know. I think there's a lot of traditionalists who are just staunchly, this is where jazz stopped. And that's how you know jazz is a real art form. You know, painting has the same thing, dance has the same thing. It's like, this. Some people say classical music stopped, you know, at this era with this composer, and that's it, you know. For me, I like all of it, you know. I think there's room for all of it. I think there's room for experimental stuff and pushing it forward and bringing in, you know, music from all around the world. You know, to me, there hasn't been a more exciting time than now for music. And what better time to, you know, work with different people, try different things around the world and bring it in. But never lose sight of where we come from. That's the core thing for jazz. So I think it's going to be a good era for jazz, personally.
Because jazz is America's own creation.
That's right.
And yet open to global musical influences. Dizzy Gillespie, of course, being one of the, you know, leaders of Latin jazz. Mm-hmm. He's an African-American man who falls in love with Afro-Cuban music.
That's right.
And you know, helps to bring it to the world along with so many other artists. As the music historian you are, you probably appreciate this story. When I was in my 20s, Artie Shaw invited me to his house out in Newbury Park in Ventura County. And so I went out to his house. He wanted to talk about jazz and radio.
Wow.
And the great band leader, clarinetist, of course, huge recording artist in the 40s who had left music. But Artie Shaw told me, he said, you know, one of the great things about the big band era is that jazz and American popular music were sort of on these particular arcs, and they met up in the big band era, so that America's popular music was much of us actually this jazz music that was influenced by African American artists. And he said, and then they sort of, you know, went their separate ways. Mm. And I was curious your thoughts about that, because it seems like there is an openness to melding now that maybe there wasn't in previous decades.
I think you're right. You know, I think there's just more options, you know. For me, jazz artists, myself included, are sort of insatiable curiosity nuts, you know, like we just want to know more and more, and we hear the jazz. I mean, to me, when I use that word, when I listen to Off the Wall, I hear the jazz in there because it's Quincy Jones.
Well, and all those jazz musicians Quincy used in that session.
Exactly. So it's like they're in there, you know, in 1978. Yeah. Everyone's a jazz musician, even if we're not playing jazz with a capital J. But yeah, I think it's exactly like you said. You know, it's all connected. You know, and I got to salute Robert Glasper in particular, because he's really trying to keep that both things.
Yeah,
happen.
And he records in you know, fairly straight ahead jazz, and he's great, and stuff that's futuristic, vocoder, and all this other
exactly.
stuff, and that's cool too.
Yeah.
So, hey, we've got like 2 minutes left. Would you mind playing Ain't No Sunshine to take us into our break?
It would be my honor. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, yeah. It's not warm when she's away, yeah. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and she's always gone too long. Anytime she goes away, yeah. Wonder this time where she's gone, 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 yeah. Wonder if she's gonna stay. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away. And I know, hey, I ought to leave the young thing alone. But ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, gone, gone. Only darkness every day, yeah, yeah. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone, and this house just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away, oh.
Jose James with us live in studio on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Jose, this has been an absolute delight. I've so enjoyed talking with you about music and your music particularly. Congratulations on the new album, 1978.
Thank you, sir. It's been an honor and a privilege.
Thanks. We'll look forward to seeing you up on stage in
person, sir.
Yes, sir. Jose James, Southern California resident, Minneapolis born. We take you to the end of this hour with the 2018 recording Lean On Me, title track of the Bill Withers tribute album. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3.
We all have sorrow, but if we are...
The journalists of LAist work for you.
I'm LAist Immigrant Communities correspondent Leslie Bearstein Rojas.
For many, this has been their only job since immigrating to the United States.
My work connects communities, helping us discover one another, better understand how immigrants are changing LA, and how LA changes immigrants.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
And the four great heroes of the West, who've been through training that said everyone is to be treated with dignity. You are to love everyone within the environs of greater Los Angeles, and you have a club on your side and a gun on your side and the National Guard at your back and the Army, Navy, and Marines waiting to come to your rescue. You don't have to be a bully force, and yet they crucified little Rodney.
Mama.
I feared for my life. Surrounded by 20 armed police persons, poor little Rodney, prostrate, couldn't even help himself if they wanted to. But they love all the citizens. They love all the sheep, except the black sheep.
You're listening to the late Reverend Cecil Murray speaking to his congregation at First African Methodist Episcopal Church, Sunday, May 3rd, 1992. His sermon came during the time of unrest in the city of Los Angeles. He had a strong critique about what he saw as inequities within the city and was not shy about being critical of law enforcement as well, as you just heard in the Reverend Chip Murray's comments. He was a giant in Los Angeles, and at a particularly important time in the city's evolution when tensions were so high. He built First AME, which was historically the first black church in Los Angeles, into a political and social powerhouse in the city. He died at his home in the View Park, Windsor Hills area of Los Angeles Friday night at the age of 94. We're going to begin this hour by remembering Chip Murray and the huge impact that he had on the city of Los Angeles. I just begin by sharing a statement from LA Mayor Karen Bass, who said on Friday, "Today we lost a giant. Reverend Dr. Cecil Murray dedicated his life to service, community, and putting God first in all things. I had the absolute honor of working with him, worshiping with him, and seeking his counsel. My heart is with the First AME congregation and community today as we reflect on a legacy that changed this city forever. Former LAPD chief and former LA City Council member Bernard Park said, "I worked closely with the pastor for several years. He was a pillar of honesty and integrity and a true community leader. After leaving the LAPD, I continued to work with him and his congregation as a council member. Upon his retirement, I initiated a city proclamation that officially renamed the traffic circle in front of the church the Cecil Murray Circle." Also joining us on Air Talk to share his memories is Kerman Maddox, a longtime member of First AME Church, Jan Perrys, a former 9th District LA City Council member, and we have more comments to share. But I also want to hear from you. As an Air Talk listener, if you knew Chip Murray, if you worshiped at First AME and you knew of his power from the pulpit, as well as his influence on our city, I'd love to hear your memories of the man. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also email us at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. I always loved talking with Chip because he is such an elegant man and such a dynamic speaker, a powerhouse, and someone who loved this city, not just his congregants, for whom he obviously cared so much, but for this city as a whole, and wanted it to be healthy and to be well and to be a place of deep and mutual respect. And with his time with us on this program over the years, I just have such fond memories of him as a person and a presence in our community. Jan Perry, thank you so much for joining us and your memories of the Reverend and what he meant to this city.
Well, I think he was a gift to this city. He was so wise and passionate and so willing to offer sage counsel. He had an expression which I'm sure he used with a lot of people, which is welcome, daughter, hello, daughter, you know, and, you know, I'm sure that he called a lot of people daughter. But when he said those words, I always felt that he heard me, that he saw me, and that I was included. But my greatest memory of him, aside from the incredible sermons he gave, was on the night that we had the civil unrest, and so many of us were at First AME, and he was speaking, you know, to the people assembled there to try to get people to calm down. And we were at the back of the church, I think, after he was done speaking. And there was smoke everywhere, loud noises, police sirens. You can hear transformers blowing up. And I remember standing on the sidewalk in the back side of the church. If you know the church, you know it's up on a hill, and looking southward and seeing what was going on. And you know, he had enormous eyes, and he had tears in his eyes. And you could see that love for this city and not only his people, but all people was so deep and so profound that it was very, very painful to see him like that. But it was also beautiful because it was a pure expression of who he authentically was.
Jan, you mentioned his eyes, and, you know, he had that ability of, you know, that the most gifted people in public life have, you know, when he looked at you, you felt his presence, you felt his warmth, his intensity. And I'm glad you mentioned that because you saw the pain in his eyes that night at First AME. But talk a bit about that, his countenance and the power of his physical presence.
Well, you know, anybody who was in politics would always go in and seek his counsel, and it was an honor to be able to get an appointment, to be able to have an audience with him, if you will, in his office, either before he went to preach or maybe quieter times during the week. And, you know, he actually listened. He would meet your gaze. He would give comment, both positive and critique, and tell you where he thought you were going right and where he thought you were going wrong. But he was never one to hold back, which I really appreciated. It's a unique skill, because even when he spoke, even if he didn't agree with you, you still felt like you were loved and that you were heard and that you were seen by him.
Jan Perry, former 9th District L.A. City Council member, joining us to talk about her memories of the Reverend Cecil Chip Murray, who was for many years the pastor of First AME Church of Los Angeles, and not just an important spiritual and religious leader for the city, but political leader as well. Kerman Maddox, longtime member of First AME and former chair of the Political and Community Outreach Committee, established back in 1985 under the Reverend Murray's leadership. Kerman, thank you for being with us so much. I'm sure you have so many memories. It's hard to pick just a couple or so to share, but your overall memories of him.
Yeah, first, thank you, Larry, for giving me this opportunity. Yeah, I joined First ME Church back in 1985, and if anyone knows Reverend Chip Murray, he's one of these guys. We had a conversation one day in his office. He says, "Kerm," which is what he's called me, "we're going to start a political and community action committee, and I'd like you to consider chairing it." I said, "Well, I'm a new member. Let me just kind of feel things out first." And then the following Sunday in church, he asked me to stand up and announce to the entire congregation, this new member, Mr. Maddox, is now the chair of the Political and Social Outreach Committee. And so if you know Chip Murray, that was just the way he operated. So I have many, many memories. Jan Perry, the former council member, mentioned the night of 1992, where everybody knows the call was to, once the verdict came in, Reverend Murray asked everybody to show up at the church instantaneously because we wanted to hear from the elected officials. We wanted to get involved. Larry, he had this model, first to serve, and he believed prayer with feet was the underguiding principle of First ME Church. And what that meant, Larry, is we don't just pray for things to get better. We actually pray and actively get involved. And he knew that night there was a real potential that things were going to go badly. And he asked all the men of the church to be there and be prepared to protect the people who were visiting, many elected officials, many media members, many dignitaries. The men of the church physically walked them to their cars to get there to make sure they were safe, because if many people remember, flashpoint number 2 was Adams and Western, which is right around the corner from First ME Church. So he had a loving spirit. He had a big heart. But most importantly, Larry, he had this unique ability to really connect with people no matter what their station in life. There are many instances where I'd be in his office getting ready to go in for an appointment, and some lady would come in off the streets who was not a member, clearly grief-stricken, and something was going on in their life. He would say, "Kerm, take a seat. Let me talk to this lady." He'd talk to them even though she didn't have an appointment. After she left, I'd go in, he'd say, "She just lost her 16-year-old son to gang violence. He's dead. I need to get involved and help." So that was Reverend Murray. His door was always open. He was always willing to help people, whether you were a member or not. And you're right. He took that sleepy little church, as we used to call it, that had less than 1,000 members when I joined, to over 18,000 active members by the time he retired.
He had a huge footprint in Los Angeles. He also had, I don't know if you'd call it entrepreneurial, but in a sense, I think of it that way, because with the Renaissance Center, essentially was launching a business on behalf of the community for job development and providing services to the community. I wonder if you can speak a bit to that, because it was almost audacious in a sense, but he pulled it off.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. So what was happening in South L.A., Larry, is Rebuild L.A. was the entity that was supposed to help revitalize and bring South L.A. back. And a lot of the African-American small business owners and residents just didn't see anything happening in the community. And so he decided we as a church need to figure out a way to take our religious philosophy and infuse it with economics and do something about it. He came up with the idea of starting a community development corporation at that time, which was very revolutionary. And he came up with FAME Assistance Corporation, eventually run by Mark Whitlock, who was one of the assistant ministers. And the theory was this, Larry: let's invest in our own community. Let's take resources from people who want to invest in South LA, and let's make sure the dollars go to people in need. small businesses in the community. Let's set up grant programs. Let's set up training programs. Let's teach people how to be entrepreneurial. That was his vision, and that was the beginning of FAME Assistance Corporation. So he was always a visionary, Larry, and economic development and economic sustainability for the area surrounding the church and the larger Black community was incredibly important to Reverend Cecil Murray. And in that regard, he kind of stood out.
We're talking with Kerman Maddox, a man who's been so much at the center of Los Angeles political life for many years, involved with so many campaigns, a longtime member of First AME Church, and the former chair of the Political and Community Outreach Committee established under the Reverend Cecil Murray's leadership in 1985. I didn't realize until I was reading one of the obituaries that Reverend Murray was a fifth-generation AME. It went back that far in his family. That was amazing.
Yeah, the AME church ran through his bloodline and through everybody, a fiber in his body, and he just genuinely believed in it. And so you're right, it was just something that was part of his DNA. And the thing that was really interesting about him, Larry, is when in the 1980s, when the church started to really take off in terms of membership, he did something that was very revolutionary for Black churches at that time. He mixed the older people who had been there forever and had been used to doing things their way with younger people and then younger professionals like myself and women. He gave women leadership roles in the church. He gave young professionals and other young people like me leadership roles. Now, that was a little controversial because you had a lot of longstanding members, much older than us, who were used to doing things their way, and he just had a greater vision, and it worked.
Kerman, thank you so much for remembering the Reverend Cecil Chip Murray, longtime pastor of First AME Church of Los Angeles. Thank you so much for taking the time with us today on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry.
Appreciate it. And Jan Perry, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your memories as well. Jan Perry, former 9th District LA City Council member. Connie Rice, such a prominent civil rights voice and attorney in Los Angeles for many years, shared with me, I saw Chip Murray as a one-man SEAL team for the Sermon on the Mount. I'll always remember him saying, Connie, if we can't make multiracial democracy work here in L.A., it can't work anywhere. He championed L.A.'s human tapestry as a gospel of Christ. Like the Reverend Jim Lawson, there will never be another man like him. That's Connie Rice, civil rights attorney and activist. It's Air Talk on LA, 89.3. Coming up, confirmation, perhaps in a new study, that those of us that have dogs really are communicating certain words to our pets. We'll come back and hear about the study in just a minute.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
We have breaking news. The Arizona Supreme Court has just ruled that the state can enforce its long-dormant law criminalizing all abortions except when a mother's life is at stake. The case examined whether the state is still subject to a law that predates Arizona's statehood. The 1864 law provides no exceptions for rape or incest, but allows abortions if a mother's life is in danger. The Arizona High Court ruling reviewed a 2022 decision by the State Court of Appeals that said doctors couldn't be charged for performing the procedure in the first 15 weeks of pregnancy. Again, the Arizona Supreme Court ruling today, the state can enforce its 1864 law that largely bans abortion. It's Air Talk on LA, 89.3. Well, For many of us who have dogs, we feel pretty confident that our dog understands certain words. Maybe it's a name that's given to a toy. Maybe it's just saying your dinner is ready or something like that. And we're sure that our dog understands precisely the word that we're using and what it means. But there's a new study that's been conducted which actually looked at the brain waves of dogs as the owner held up an object that either matched or didn't match the word that was typically used for that item. And we'll talk about the findings with Mariana Boros, who's a cognitive neuroscientist and postdoctoral researcher at Eötvös Loránd University's Neuroethology of Communication Lab in Budapest. Mariana is the co-lead author of the study. Thank you so much, Dr. Boros. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
So,
hello, everyone.
Share with us just how this study was conducted and how you had the owners of the dogs participating in the study.
Well, actually, that wasn't very easy. So, as you said, most dog owners will claim that their dogs understand a lot, and or even some would claim everything that they say. But actually, when scientists look into that more rigorously, it turns out that most dogs, when they are tested whether they know the names of their toys, they remain at chance level. So when they have a simple task to fetch decide and fetch one from two objects based on the object label, they will decide on chance. So actually, it's not so straightforward. The dogs know the names of their toys. So there are some exceptional dogs who know that, mm-hmm. who can learn hundreds of object names without even being trained, just in simple play with their owners. But we ask ourselves whether it is really that the dogs don't know the word, don't understand those words, or they have just problems with the testing situation. So we set out on we put calls on our media platform. So the Department of Ethology of the Eötvös Loránd University in Hungary has a huge follower base. And so we put out calls looking for dogs who the owner believed that know at least names of three objects. And that wasn't very easy to find. But finally, over, I think, 3 years, we managed to test 27 dogs whose so-called noun vocabulary ranged from five objects to more than 230. And we tested them using non-invasive EEG, which is a brain measure.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I read, it looked like when you had the owner hold up an object different than the one that was said to the dog. So let's say the word ball is said, but you actually hold up a brick, that you then see brain activity on the EEG indicating the dog's trying to figure it out. If it's not what the dog thought the word was, that's what told you whether the dog understood or not. Is that right?
Exactly. So we figured that if the dogs understand the word, so in humans, we typically say that understanding the word means that we don't just link the word to the object itself, but we have an idea of that thing, a concept in our mind that is activated when we say the word. So we figured that we actually wanted to study the same thing in dogs. So when we thought that if the dog hears the word and has this idea, this mental representation of that object activated, then it has an expectation to what it is going to see. And holding up a different object will violate this expectation. And in human EEG studies, we know that such a violation is resulting in a stronger EEG signal. It is called an event-related response, which is bigger when the expectation is violated as opposed to when the object meets the expectation. And this is exactly what we found in dogs as well.
We're talking with the co-lead author of the study that was published recently in the journal Current Biology, Mariana Boros, with us, cognitive neuroscientist and postdoctoral researcher, joining us from Budapest, where research is being done at Eötvös Loránd University's Neuroethology of Communication Lab. Also with us is Mark Beckhoff, who is professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's author of Dogs Demystified, an A to Z Guide to All Things Canine, and another book, The Emotional Lives of Animals. Professor Beckhoff, thank you for being with us. Your thoughts about the significance of the research that Mariana and her colleagues have done.
I think it's a really very important and interesting study. For a number of reasons, there was no real specific training, you know, overtraining, because sometimes when you train dogs or other animals to do something and you overtrain them, you can get them to do almost whatever you want. And you pointed out, and Mariana did too, that what's really interesting to me is to get that EEG, the surprise EEG. And I was thinking about what the study meant, because I used to live in the mountains and I would have my own dogs there and other dogs, and without any specific training, I mean, there was no doubt that they knew the name of certain objects. They knew the name of other dogs, but of course we couldn't do the EEG. So I think this is really a landmark study.
Yeah, it shows that because, as she said, you know, there was often chance involved as to, you know, what dogs really knew in the way of words, and this helps to quantify it. I wonder, Mariana, with such a difference between some dogs, you mentioned there these outlier dogs that, you know, learn hundreds of words or whatever. Is there anything that's suggested in this study about what accounts for that difference? Is it brain capacity? Is it just cognitive skill in the particular dogs? Or do we have a sense of why this is?
No, unfortunately, I don't know. We don't know. So we actually tested whether there is any correlation. So any if this mismatch response, the size of the mismatch response somehow is affected, for example, by age or the head shape of the dogs. So head shape is a kind of a proxy for breed, but we did not find any indication that these would matter for the ability to understand those words. So this is interesting what you point out, that there was a huge variation in the number of words, object words, those dogs know, and still we found no correlation with the vocabulary size as well. So this kind of suggests that the capacity is there overall in dogs in general. They don't have to be these very good word learners to understand these words in this referential manner.
All right. And what does this suggest in the way of follow-up study? Because I know researchers like yourself are always looking at, okay, here's what we learned here. Here's what we want to do in the next study. What would that be?
Well, there are many, many ways to go, actually. So I think one limitation of our study is that we use the objects of the dogs, so the real toys of the dogs. So actually, we could only test whether, if I say to my dog, ball, whether he will understand that it means his ball, but we don't know if he will generalize this to any kind of ball, and we know obviously that humans do that. So that's one question that should do a follow-up study looking into that. Then there are actually showing this ERP component for this expectation violation also opens up many doors into testing knowledge, general knowledge, dog knowledge about their surrounding world, like physical cognition, social cognition, and other language related knowledge. So so there are many questions that, we could test now. And also a question is how such a capacity emerged in dogs, whether this is due to their domestication, whether there are other mammals who would show a similar response. So it would be great to find other mammals or other species that could be tested in a similar way.
I know it's probably more complicated to research, but I'm also fascinated in dogs' ability to problem solve because it seems so variable, at least in the dogs that I've had in my life, between ones who are quite good at solving problems and others for whom it seemed to be a much bigger challenge. And be interesting to get a sense of what that range is and the factors behind that with dogs. Thank you so much, Dr. Boros, for joining us. We appreciate you being with us very much on our program today and talking about your study.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's Dr. Mariana Boros, cognitive neuroscientist, and my thanks to Professor Emeritus, University of Colorado Boulder, Mark Beckoff, author of Dogs Demystified and the Emotional Lives of Animals. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk about the history of the Village Voice, which was the nation's most prominent alternative weekly publication. But it also spawned a whole host of alternative newspapers across the United States. The Chicago Reader, the LA Weekly, so many different papers, the Bay Area Guardian up in the San Francisco Bay Area. And most of those have fallen by the wayside in the years since, but they had a huge place culturally and socially within American journalism. We're going to be talking with Tricia Romano, author of The Freaks Came Out to Write, the definitive history of The Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. We'll also be talking with the LA Times' Gustavo Arellano, who was the editor of the OC Weekly for a number of years, one of those alternative publications with a great presence in Orange County. We'll be back with more in just 90 seconds.
The stakes to save the Colorado River are high.
So if there's no water, there's no water for everybody.
California and six other states on the river must reach a compromise, but they're divided. The fate of the river may come down to a 28-year-old.
This is a historic thing coming.
The people and the real human drama behind the historic negotiations. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water deal maker, wherever you get podcasts.
It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. I'm Larry Mantle. We have breaking news. The state of California has spent $24 billion to address homelessness over a five-year period, but according to a state audit released this morning, the state didn't consistently track the outcomes or effectiveness of its programs. The report attempts to assess how effective state and local cities have been in spending billions of dollars to address homelessness. And the report found the California Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is responsible for coordinating agencies and allocating resources for programs, stopped tracking data related to five initiatives back in 2021, despite continuous funding from the state. The state auditor's report also claims that council failed to develop plan to collect and evaluate outcome data of the programs due to the lack of a consistent method. More than likely, we'll be talking about this on tomorrow's Air Talk, but I just wanted to give you the breaking news. The state auditor's report just out, and it found that the state of California has not tracked $24 billion that have been spent over 5 years on homelessness. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. And we turn our attention now to alternative newspapers, such a big part of America's cultural and social landscape, with publications going back to the LA Weekly here in Los Angeles, the Village Voice, which is really the grandmother or granddaddy of the alternative press, and Tricia Romano joining us. She was with us last week, by the way, for another segment, but she was at the Village Voice for a number of years, eight of them total, beginning as an intern. As a contributing writer, she wrote features and award-winning cover stories about culture and music. Her reported column, Fly Life, looked at New York nightlife. She's been a staff writer at Seattle Times, served as editor-in-chief of The Stranger, which was Seattle's alternative newspaper, and she joins us to talk about her new book, The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. Tricia Romano, good to have you with us again on Air Talk.
Thank you. Great to be back.
So this is really an oral history in so many ways. You talk with people who wrote for the paper, had wonderful stories to share. But let's go back to the origins. Three writers started the paper. And what was it designed to do in its first editions of the paper?
Well, Ed Fancher, Dan Wolf, and Norman Mailer got together. They lived in Greenwich Village in the 50s, and they didn't see a newspaper that really reflected their lives, you know, the lives where they were going to bars and having drinks with James Baldwin and, you know, watching beat poets perform and going to off Broadway plays. You know, it just didn't, there was nothing in the city that actually wrote about those things. And they thought, well, why don't we try it? So they got a little money from Ed Fancher's parents and from Norman Mailer, who had just had a big success, and they decided to give it a whirl. And they barely knew what they were doing. And they, you know, basically hung on for dear life for the first 5 or 6 years.
And it's when we think of it as not just a New York-centric publication, but with national influence. When did that start to assert itself?
I mean, I think in a way, probably in the 70s is when it really became more national, late 70s, early 80s. But, you know, it represented the downtown of, you know, almost any major city. Where, you know, there's similarities between, you know, LA or San Francisco or New York, where there's a certain, you know, bohemian ethic that existed that wasn't really getting paid attention to in the same way. And most people all sort of sought out the voice. But, you know, by the 80s, it had become much more professionalized, and they started writing cover stories that were universal. And, you know, the other thing is that New York was sort of, it's a media center, and what happens in New York gets spread nationally because of all the media that is there. And for a really long time, New York was the center of culture and in the United States and even the world, especially when you think about like CBGB and
punk culture,
stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We're talking with Tricia Romano, author of The Freaks Came Out to Write, and we're extending beyond just The Village Voice, as influential as that publication was, but to talk about alternative newspapers across the country. And I'd love to hear from you as an Air Talk listener. If you had an alternative paper in the place where you came from, to Southern California, that was really influential in helping you develop your worldview, learning about artists, learning about politics, learning about issues that matter to you. I'd love to hear you talk about those publications, because so many major American cities had these develop after the introduction of the Village Voice. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can also post your comment on our Air Talk page at LAist.com/airtalk. Here in Los Angeles, we had the LA Free Press, nicknamed the Freep, which was started by Art Kunkin back in 1964. He was the editor-in-chief through 1973. It was finally ceased in its original life in 1978, but I remember it so well, you know, particularly in Hollywood, being a student in middle and high school there, and picking up the Free Press and reading it on my way home, and just things that you would read there that you would never find in the Los Angeles Times or the then still publishing LA Herald Examiner. Again, I'd love to hear from you about the impact of alternative newspapers, whether here in Southern California or in the city where you grew up or lived previously. 866-893-5722. Also with us, Los Angeles Times columnist Gustavo Arellano, who was the editor-in-chief of the OC Weekly, the alternative paper covering Orange County. Gustavo, good morning. Thank you for being with us. Just share with us, you know, in the heyday of the alternative newspaper, how big an impact do you think it had?
Well, it depended on what area of the United States it was. Obviously, the Village Voice had a humongous impact, not just on New York, but nationally. LA Weekly had a huge impact as well. But they were, I have to say, a lot of those papers, they're already speaking to a bohemian audience, almost like playing to the crowd. On the other hand, OC Weekly, which was the greatest alt weekly in human history, we were in the belly of the beast in Orange County, really going up against, just horrible, horrible opposition. And the Village Voice, oh gosh, now I'm trying to remember. No, we were first created by Stern Publishing, which owned OC Weekly and LA Weekly. Then the Village Voice bought out LA Weekly and OC Weekly. And then, as you know, Trisha's amazing book points out, we all got conquered by the barbarians from Phoenix, known as the New Times Publication, that then switched over their name to Voice Media Group. So in most places, they played a huge impact in that underground scene. But in other places like Orange County, we're going up against horrible people.
Well, and so there were so many important stories that you covered and that were first reported in the OC Weekly. And as you said, you know, public officials generally hated the publication, and you by association in many cases. But, you know, what was it like operating what was, you know, really a shoestring operation and trying to expose stuff?
It was fun. I mean, we really operated under the maxim, comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable, have no friends, champion nobody but the truth, and also the underdogs. And with most alt weeklies, like, you could almost close your eyes and see the type of stories that we all publish. So the Village Voice did amazing work on the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, just like OC Weekly. LA Weekly really didn't do it. There was another newspaper called New Times Los Angeles. They did amazing work. You cover the music scene, of course. You cover, the changing demographics. But I would say, especially with OC Weekly, again, we actually covered Orange County as it turned purple, when it was the bedrock of the GOP in the United States. Through all these historic wins, we covered, you know, corruption scandals. We got innocent people out of jail. We got guilty politicians in jail. And another thing that the alt weeklies did great, that I then knew, you know, the daily newspapers did as well, but I just think alt weeklies always had an advantage on this, is historical journalism. You take stories that never made it into the mainstream and you spin these incredible tales out of this. Like at the OC Weekly, we're doing stories about citrus strikes, about the Great Flood of 1938, which, you know, the biggest flood in Southern California history, also affected LA. But I was able to find that most of the victims in Orange County were Mexicans, and that people, you know, the more things change, the more they remain the same. People were trying to stop these victims that live right next to the Santa Ana River of getting any public assistance because they were Mexican.
Joining us, Gustavo Arellano, the LA Times columnist, who for a number of years was the editor of OC Weekly. And we're talking about the impact of alternative newspapers. We're talking about the Village Voice, which was really the first of these, created in the 1950s. And Tricia Romano's new book, The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. She's with us, as well as Gustavo. I'd like to hear from you. Was some of the most impressive journalism or aspects of alternative weeklies? Because one of the things I loved as a regular reader of the LA Weekly was the in-depth theater coverage. I mean, virtually anything that was shown on a stage that had more than a dozen people that would be attending a performance got covered. That's something the Los Angeles Times, even when it was regularly doing larger theater, would not give you that kind of depth. You were getting in-depth profiles profiles of independent cinema that often you would not find in major American papers. But you'd have the director, you know, up-and-coming directors, people like Jim Jarmusch and, you know, people that were, you know, not getting as much attention, who later got more in the mainstream papers, but first came to public attention in alternative media. 866-893-5722, or you can email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Julie in Monterey Park, thank you so much for joining us. Share with us one of your favorite alternative papers.
So there was a beautiful, wonderful little publication called LA Youth back in the 90s. And I remember a friend told me to come and write for it because I was interested in journalism. And so we took the bus. We went, you know, into, you know, somewhere out in Wilshire. And it was run by this editor. Her name was Libby. I wish I could remember her last name. But it was young people from all across Los Angeles. So, you know, I met other Asian American kids from other neighborhoods. I met Jewish kids. I met other African American kids. It was so beautiful. And so long as it was something that you cared about, that you could write for the newspaper. And it was very egalitarian. And it was, you know, it took on this very multicultural voice. And it was just kids from all walks of life, not just racially, but even in terms of class. It was so beautiful.
Yeah.
Something in the 90s, yeah.
LA Youth, it was called. Julie, thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing that. Craig and La Crescenta emailed us, Flipside Magazine was a great resource for punk music and politics. And Tamar in Pasadena said there used to be a magazine in New York called Pop Smear Super Alternative. All right, I want to hear from you. Some of your favorite alternative publications. We're at 866-89. 93-5722, laist.com/airtalk, where you can post your comment. And I also want to encourage you on our AirTalk page, laist.com/airtalk, please sign up using your email to get the brand new newsletter that we're going to be sending out starting next week, every week, AirTalk Weekly, in which I'll be connecting with you on some of the favorite segments we have coming up or that we've done in the past. I'll share things that are happening behind the scenes at AirTalk. It's a chance for you to hear from me beyond the daily program every week with AirTalk Weekly. Please sign up, get your free subscription in so that every week you'll get my email and my message in your inbox. It's AirTalk. We'll be back in a minute. We're talking about alternative weekly publications. Sylvia and Marina Del Rey said LA Weekly was my go-to until it disappeared, especially informative on how LAUSD was functioning. And Joe in Burbank says we relied on the LA Weekly as one of the means to develop our aesthetics in theater. It was our entree, and we loved that it was LA-centric. We didn't have to look to New York anymore. We're joined by Tricia Romano, who is the author of The Freaks Came Out to Write, The Definitive History of the Village Voice, the radical paper that changed American culture. Tricia, what effect did The Voice have on New York theater?
Well, what's interesting is that one of the first editors at The Voice was a guy named Jerry Talmer, and he was very, very interested in theater. And so from the beginning, The Voice had comprehensive theater listings, including off-Broadway and off-Broadway, which, you know, you couldn't find anywhere else. And Jerry also started the Obie Awards, which was a theater award specifically for off-Broadway and off-Broadway productions. And so he was responsible for really shining a light on up-and-coming talent, playwrights, actors, directors, and, you know, not concerned with the status quo. It was also a very interesting award because you couldn't, it wasn't a competition. You know, there was a board that nominated you. There was just one person. You didn't know that you were going to get it until the night you got it. You just got invited.
Yeah.
You couldn't lobby for it, you know. And so in a way, it was a very special award to get. And, you know, in the book, I think I quote Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. You know, they were one of the earlier recipients of an Obie, and they basically said, you know, until I got this, I didn't know if I was any good.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing for Al Pacino to say that. Trisha Romano's author of The Freaks came out to write The Definitive History of the Village Voice, The Radical Paper That Changed American Culture. And she'll be in conversation with a Vanity Fair correspondent, Joy Press, this Friday night, 7 o'clock at Book Soup on the Sunset Strip. That's Trisha Romano talking with Vanity Fair's Joy Press at Book Soup this coming Friday night at 7 o'clock. Jen in Silver Lake emailed, I recall BAM for Bay Area Music from the early 90s having great coverage of the alternative music scene and being available in LA record stores. Yeah, I remember BAM as well. Bill in Alhambra says, the San Diego Reader. I used to read it as a student at UC San Diego. It helped give me a feeling for the community, its history, and life in the area. Ken in North Hollywood, good to have you with us. I understand you went back to working at the LA Free Press. You were there in the mid and late 70s?
Yeah. Hi, Larry. I was there from about 1976 through its demise in 1978. I was there during that transition when it went from a local ownership to Larry Flint of Hustler magazine fame. And that was a crazy transition.
I'll bet. So when you first arrived, what were some of the stories the LA Free Press was doing?
Oh, it was local, local issues. A lot of it had to do with, in those days, with legalization of marijuana, that sort of a thing. Local issues with the police, the typical alternative press affair, I guess I would claim it to be.
All right, Ken, thank you so much. Great to hear from you actually working at the LA Free Press back in the 1970s. Marissa in Altadena writes, I was in high school in the early 90s reading The Village Voice about threats to abortion rights, and it was formative. The writing was passionate and angry and part of protest culture and really laid out the stakes in a way that's very lacking right now. That's Marissa in Altadena. And we should talk about that, Tricia, because The Village Voice really pioneered this idea that the writers would put their opinion right up front, their experiences would often frame how the story was told. And that was not what you'd find in mainstream American journalism.
No, not at all. I mean, that is really its calling card, was what I think Vivian Gornick called personal journalism and advocacy journalism, which is, a part of new journalism, right? Where you are part of the thing that you're covering. You're invested in the thing that you're covering. And it makes it so much more powerful and immediate and honest, honestly. The reader doesn't have to guess which side you're on. You're telling them.
I would go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right? I mean, you're telling the reader, this is where I'm coming from. This is why I'm coming from this place. And here are facts. Here are people I've talked to that agree with me. Here are some people that disagree with me. And, you leave it to the reader to understand it like an adult.
Well, not surprisingly, as a talk show host, I've since I was a kid, freedom of speech is something I've been so attracted to. And so reading Nat Hentoff in The Village Voice and then getting to interview him on the program later and getting to talk with Nat, having grown up reading his columns, was huge for me. So The Village Voice, lamented, but with a huge impact on American journalism. Tricia Romano, thank you for being with us and talking about The Freaks Came Out to Write. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, Tricia Romano will be interviewed in conversation Friday, 7 o'clock, Book Soup on the Sunset Strip about her book. And Gustavo Arellano, LA Times columnist, frequent guest with us on Air Talk. And he was the editor of OC Weekly, sharing about that terrific publication, which this was true of so many alternative weeklies, financial struggles, and yet doing some great journalism that really had an impact on local government and covering of important issues. Stay tuned. NPR's Here and Now comes up next from all of us at AirTalk. Have a terrific rest of your day.